Good evening. This is Dr. Kayla Daniel, and you're listening to the Food Rights Hour of the Republic Broadcasting Network. And my guest tonight is Liare Keith, author of The Vegetarian Myth. Liare, we were talking about the land and how it can be used to produce food. And as I recall, only about 11% of the earth can actually be used to grow plants, grains, vegetables, etc. Is that right?
Yeah, there's way more land that's actually appropriate for grazing. So even when they, you know, the vegans make this claim about, you know, if we just turned all that land into, you know, more lentils and soybeans, and we can set aside the problems with that for a minute, but it's not even true that it could be done, because most of the planet is not actually appropriate for agriculture in any way. It's too cold, it's too hot, it's too steep, the soil is too rocky, it's too thin, it just can't be done. So, I mean, they're wrong on a really basic physical level about that.
So when you try to grow things where things don't naturally grow well, you end up doing things like having extreme irrigation and that affecting the rivers and the water table and using extreme amounts of fertilizer, which in most cases are industrial petrochemical fertilizers. And there's some other issues too, aren't there?
Yeah, there's a whole bunch. The first problem is that it simply can't be done. You'd be sort of silly in, you know, northern Canada to attempt to rip up the tundra and plant soybeans. I mean, it's laughable that anybody would even think about something like that. And for most of the planet, this is true, you know, just across the board, that the climate's not right and the land surface isn't right. You know, it's too hot or too cold or whatever, or it's too dry. So now you've got the places where you could attempt such a thing, and those are the grasslands of the world, because agriculture is based on annual grasses. So, of course, where these plants want, you know, could grow would be the grasslands. What this means is that the grasslands of our planet have been utterly devastated, because pretty much every inch that could be turned into agriculture has been turned into agriculture. And that means that all those biotic communities have been completely eradicated, which is a nice way to say extinction. So all those plants and animals are gone. Now, the other problem with doing this is that we really need to understand that agriculture itself is inherently destructive. So even given the right climate and, you know, the right land form, you know, it's basically flat, there's enough rain, all of that's there. The problem is that the moment you remove that grassland, the soil starts degrading right away. It needs the cover of those perennial polycultures. And a perennial polyculture just means perennial plants live a long time, and polyculture means there's a whole bunch. So you've got these communities of plants, many, many different members of these, you know, different kinds of plants living together, helping each other in different ways, and all together what their main goal is really to build more topsoil, because topsoil is the basis of life, of land life, anyway. And that's their main function. They cover the land with their bodies, they protect it from rain and sun, and then their root system is really what makes this all happen. Their roots are literally the habitat for the bacteria that actually do the basic work of life itself. And I had this great quote from James Nardi, who is a soil scientist, and he says, "It is to the bacteria of the soil that most of the credit for the constant renewal of our earth is due." So the bacteria are the people who are really doing that basic work of life. And they're either sequestering nitrogen out of the air, and they're breaking it down, making it available to plants, or they are actually degrading dead plant and animal material and recycling those nutrients back so that the cycle of life can continue and we can all take up nutrients again. And that's what the bacteria do. Without them, this would just be a bare rock floating around a star. So these are really, they're our grandparents. They're the people who made all of this possible. And it's the plants that give them a home, and the plant roots are where it all happens, and the plant roots physically hold the soil in place. They make a matrix for that soil. So when you clear away the prairies, the grasslands, you are taking away all of that, and what you're left with is bare soil. And the annual plants that you then plant, like corn or wheat or soy, they can't do any of those functions. Because they're annuals and not perennials. We can talk about that if you want, but you can just trust me on this if you want. There's no way that they can do what the perennial polycultures do. What this means around the globe is that we've essentially skinned the planet alive by doing agriculture. We are out of topsoil by 1950.
And I think you have said that is the number one priority we should have in terms of protecting the environment, isn't it? The topsoil.
Yeah, isn't the most destructive thing that people have done to the planet is agriculture. And, you know, people like Jared Diamond, you know, who won a Pulitzer Prize, he says that this is the biggest mistake the human race has ever made. And this is why. It's because we've made ourselves dependent on an activity that is inherently destructive. We are destroying the basis of life itself. We're destroying the soil. And you need to understand how alive soil is. You know, all these creatures that are doing this work for us, one tablespoon of topsoil can contain a million different living creatures. Okay, this is not insensate dirt. It's not dust. It's alive, and that's how profoundly alive it is. And that's what's being destroyed when we do agriculture. The moment you put a plow to that soil, you're degrading that soil.
So when vegetarians and vegans talk about honoring animals, they're missing that whole point entirely, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. And they also don't understand that this is biotic cleansing. You know, that when you take a piece of land and you clear all the life off it, it means that all those plants and animals have nowhere to go. And this has driven species after species into extinction. And, you know, for our first 4 million years on this planet, we didn't do that. We didn't behave like these sort of monstrous creatures that took over. We participated in those living communities, in those perennial polycultures. We had a role just like other animals. So we were part of those soil-building communities by doing the things that, you know, apex predators do. And that's our role, and that's, you know, it's a good thing. We need predators in the world. You know, bears are important, wolves are important, humans are important. You know, we did things that helped our communities, you know, continue on. But in the last 10,000 years, we've just seen this destruction across the planet, and it's, you know, agriculture is the main activity that has caused that.
And we do need the animals to build the topsoil back again, don't we? I know, Joel Salatin's books are so amazing in how he describes the whole process of having layers and layers of animals and plantings and all of these different factors in rebuilding topsoil. And boy, does he rebuild it.
Yeah, his farm is amazing. They've actually had to dig up and move the fence posts because they're being buried in new topsoil. That's how fast they're building soil on that farm, that they've had to, you know, raise the fence posts. That is an amazing thing. That's the only place in the country that's doing this. You've just never heard anything like it. It's an absolute miracle, and it's happening in our lifetime. So, he's somebody that's well worth reading his work. It's just incredible what he's managed to do. But one of the most healing things for the land is actually ruminants, our ruminant animals. We've got millions of acres that have been ravaged around the planet, and they've been ravaged by grain, you know, by those annual monocrops. And when you replant with the grassland, the prairie plants that are those perennials, right away you can see the life come back to the land, because you're providing habitat for all kinds of other creatures and because you're building that topsoil back. But, you know, one of the things that ruminants do is, and this is the way that ruminants and grasses have developed together. You know, it's a symbiotic relationship. When grass is eaten, unlike other plants, it actually makes grass stronger. As long as it's not chewed down to the, you know, down to the bone, down to the ground. But the way that a ruminant will eat it, it's fine. And then what happens is it actually stimulates root growth for that plant that's been eaten. So they now have a stronger root system because the animals chopped it from the top. Other plants are not like that, but grasses and ruminants evolve together, and so you can see that they help each other. The grasses feed the ruminants, and then the ruminants stimulate the plant growth. The ruminants also, of course, spread manure and their waste products everywhere, just naturally, and that provides nitrogen for the plants in very dry environments or during the summer. All of that urine is, you know, one of the major sources of water for the plants as well.
This really is so amazing, because I think so many of us have been taught to believe that the only way to save land was to basically put it into some sort of conservation idea where it cannot be touched. And that doesn't work at all compared to how well it works when somebody like Joel with his talents goes in and rebuilds the soil, rebuilds the land.
Yeah, you know, it's hard to rebuild it without having some human participation at this point, especially. So much of it's been so destroyed that it really comes back faster if we play a positive role rather than a destructive role. There's also, I don't agree that humans don't belong. I mean, we have a place. You know, we, like the other apex predators, we have a role to play on this planet. And as long as we do that well, you know, and we stop destroying things, it's not, you know, it's not bad that we exist. You know, we also evolved on this planet, and we have a, you know, our own specific kind of gift to bring to our to the living community, to the biotic world.
And Leah, you've contributed a great deal to this thinking, I believe. Your vegetarian myth book, how many copies have you sold so far?
Oh, we're in our sixth printing, so I think we've got about 15,000 in print.
Wow, well, good for you.
Yeah.
And this is a book that I believe only you could have written. I mean, you are such a good writer. But, you know, some of us, you know, I mean, I could say, like, I knew some of this, but I could not have written that book because that was your book, because you've been a vegan for, what, 22 years? Was that,
20,
is that
almost
right?
20 years. Yeah, 20 years. Yep.
20 years. And that just gave you a perspective and I think a compassion for veganism and vegetarians because you've been there.
Yeah, and I understand the worldview very well because it was my worldview for so long. And I always try very carefully to make the point that the values that underlie the vegetarian ethic are not at issue. So the things that matter most, justice and compassion and sustainability and really anything that questions human hubris and human entitlement, those are really the only values that are going to get us to the world that we need. So that's not the problem. Okay, so I try to say to people all the time, like, you can keep those values. You don't have to change, you know, your basic moral framework. It's just information.
Well, wonderful. We could talk some more about that after the break. This is Dr. Kayla Daniel, and my guest is Lier Keith.
Hey, honey, I'm home. I grabbed a newspaper on the way home. Look at all the news today.
Don't you know that all you're going to get in the newspaper is propaganda, twisted news, and false information?
Honey, this is a national newspaper. It has to be true.
Ha! For some reason, the majority of the population believe anything the mainstream media tells them. The newspaper doesn't give out the important attention of what's happening to this country and news that affects our daily lives. Say, does that newspaper mention anything about the North American Union?
No, not that I can see.
I didn't think so. You need to go to www.newswithviews.com, where truth is more important than political correctness. That's www.newswithviews.com. Hey, don't throw that away. We can use that in the birdcage.
Okay, move over. Let me start reading newswithviews.com.
The truth? Read all about it at newswithviews.com. Newswithviews.com, where reality shatters illusion.
Do you flinch when a police car appears in your rearview mirror or you get pulled over? Are you squeamish when an envelope arrives in the mail with a return address of a court, a government agency like the IRS, or some law firm? Would you like to escape government agency harassment? Then visit escapeharassment.com. George Bush allegedly says, the government constitution is nothing but a doggone piece of paper. Well, that's a contract. A contract is an offer acceptance of that offer, at which point a contract arises by law and the offeror can no longer withdraw the offer. We teach, do not accept. That way there is no contract or agreement for you to go to their court or private club meeting. To escape government agency harassment like the IRS, visit escapeharassment.com. This is a tried and proven experienced process, not experimental, with a money-back guarantee that it works and success testimonials from previous students. Remember, escapeharassment.com. That's escapeharassment.com.
Are skyrocketing prescription costs draining your budget? If you don't have insurance or are taking medication not covered by insurance, the Powerhouse Savings Card can lower your prescription costs by up to 50%. Now you and your family can save 20 to 50% on all prescriptions. It's accepted by most pharmacies and mail order pharmacies nationwide. No prescription card is easier to use. Just show your card and save 20 to 50% right on the spot. There are no monthly fees, just a one-time processing fee of only $4.95 for you and your immediate family. Stop paying full price for prescriptions. Stop going without the medication you need because it costs too much. Now your family can get the prescriptions they need at a cost you can afford. Call 1-800-963-0232 now and start saving money with the Powerhouse Savings Card. Call 1-800-963-0232. 1-800-963-0232. 1-800-963-0232.
Dr. Kayla Daniel, and you are tuned in to the Food Rights Hour of the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund. And my guest tonight is Lierre Keith. Lierre, tell us how your book, The Vegetarian Myth, has been received.
I would say mostly it's been very positive. I get fan mail almost every day, and I'd say 80% of it is from recently ex-vegans who read my book, and they saw themselves reflected. So they were able to sort of follow along because I spoke to them from where they are. And they saw themselves reflected in the health problems that they have developed. And it's really hard for them because it means giving up a lot of this ideology. The thing about being a vegan is that it's not just what you eat. It really becomes who you are. So it's your identity. And it's really hard when that starts to crumble. So it's a hard day. But, you know, when your health is at stake, you have to do it. So they get to the nutrition chapter, and it really all falls apart because they start to see that, indeed, they have every single one of these problems and that this is not a plan with a future. And usually they write to me after this has been going on for a few months, and they've already begun to eat animal products again. And I get these amazing letters where they say, you saved my life. And that, you know, you can't not be moved when you get letters like that. And that's about 80% of them. And I'd say the rest are people who, they're either about to be ex-vegans and they need a little hand-holding because it is hard. And they need to know that we've been through this already and that it's, they'll live. It'll be all right. And then they'll feel better. And, you know, you can put yourself back together in a different way, but you don't have to, like I said before, you don't have to change those basic values, that you can still care about all these things, but you'll have bigger information.
Right. Now, when you decided to make the switch, of course, you didn't have your own book to draw on, so you've really blessed all these people. You've really put it together for them.
Yeah, and that was one of my goals, was I didn't want the next generation of idealistic young people, especially, to do what I had done. I mean, my health is permanently damaged. And there's a whole generation of us out here who can say that now, that we tried it long-term and we ended up, you know, with permanent problems. And it was for no good reason. And nothing was served by our suffering. And it's really hard to watch that happen to a whole bunch of other people.
It really is, because we see the best intentions. We see that many of the people who are susceptible to these vegan myths are some of our most intelligent, most compassionate people. And another thing that's going on these days that really bothers me is it seems like veganism has become hip and fashionable, and they're even considering it sexy, and we have these horrible books coming out, the whole Skinny Bitch series, for example.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, I mean, we don't even really need to comment on that, because somebody who uses an expletive in every single sentence and sometimes several times isn't worth talking about. But there's just a whole lot of books, you know. There's The Veganist just came out, and there's all these plant-based diet books, and gee, sometimes it sometimes feels like we're going against a trend, and yet we know it's starting to turn around.
It is starting to turn around, and you know, most vegans will be ex-vegans someday. Most of them don't last more than 2 or 3 years, and those are the smart ones. I mean, I just let it keep going. I didn't know how to question it. I kept believing it had to be the right thing. So, you know, I went way past the point of no return. So the people who give up sooner, you know, they feel like failures, but it was like, you're smart because you actually listened to what your body was telling you. I overrode every signal I was given, you know, just because I was so ideological about it. But I do think it's changing, and the reason I think that is because of the fan mail that I get, where, you know, one person will write to me and then I'll hear again a few months later, and everybody in their social circle has now changed their minds about being a vegan, and they've all, you know, learned that animal products are good for them. They figured out where the good farms are. You know, they're reading all the Weston Price materials, and it's a huge shift in the whole circle, the whole social circle. And one of them had to be the first one to do it, and once one of them has sort of broken the barrier, then all the rest are willing to look at it. So, And that's the effect that I think my book is having, that other people are having as well. Certainly Sally Fallon's book, and I think your book has a big effect. But we are making headway. We are definitely making headway in this. And the scary part for me is watching with the children. You know, when I see people at the store buying soy milk for their young children, it's really hard because I know the damage that's going to come from that. But there's not much we can do except just keep being, you know, the educational force that we're trying to be to reach them, you know, and eventually they'll be surrounded enough. They'll have heard it five or six times from other people, and they'll be like, all right, you know, what is this you're trying to tell me? And they'll be finally, they'll be ready to let it in.
I think what you just said, sometimes you have to hear it six times. I know for myself, now I was not vegan for very long. I just felt so awful that I never lasted more than a couple months. And then I'd go back, and then I'd go, you know, then I'd read some other book, and the idea once again seemed appealing, and I decided this time around I'd have more willpower. And then I wouldn't stay on it very well. But I know that the first time I heard I needed to eat red meat, it made me angry. The second time I heard it, I was a little less angry, just tired of it. Maybe the third time I started to listen. The fourth time I thought, maybe I ought to do this. You know, I'm not feeling very good. Right. And so it goes.
Right, right. Well, and I try to remember that. And my publisher actually said that to me at one point. He said, you're basically the front line. You're the shock troops. And they're going to have to hear it eight times before they listen. Well, you're the first one, so it's the hardest time. And I think, you know, he's right about that. So, and sometimes they'll write me letters and they'll say, we've got a commercial break.
Yeah, we'll be back after the commercial break. This is Dr. Kayla Daniel, and you're tuned into the Food Rights Hour, Republic Broadcasting Network.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network because you can handle the truth.
Warning for all Gulf Coast disaster survivors. Be aware that dangerous gases are in the air you breathe. Benzene, hydrogen sulfide, methylene chloride, and Corexit 9500. Keep your body clean with micro plant powder. For all Gulf Coast residents and all who want to be healthy, HempUSA.org brings you a new formulation of micro plant powder with Lactobacillus acidophilus, rebuilding your immune system while detoxing the rest of your body, pulling out positive toxins, heavy metals, viruses, fungus, bacteria, and parasites. Cleans and purifies the blood, lungs, stomach, and colon. Microplant powder will help eliminate these dangerous chemicals from the body used in the Gulf cleanup. At HempUSA.org, we want you to try our number one selling detox product, Microplant powder. Call and order at 1-908-691-2608. 1-908-691-2608. Or visit us at HempUSA.org today.
Help, I've fallen and I can't get up. If you have an elderly loved one, please listen. Whether it's fire danger, a serious fall, or other type of home emergency, Life Alert is there for you. The company with the slogan, Help, I've Fallen and I Can't Get Up, protects 60,000 members.
The first time I fell in that bedroom and I couldn't reach the phone.
When you have a heart attack like I did and there's no one there, Life Alert was there for me.
Having a secure feeling through Life Alert is ideal.
My independence is possible because of it.
Listen to former U.S. Surgeon General Dr. C. Everett Koop.
Thanks to Life Alert, you can live alone without ever being alone. That's why I wear one.
With Life Alert protection, elderly people can often postpone going to a nursing home for several years. For a free brochure about Life Alert service, call now 1-800-410-0739. 1-800-410-0739. Call Life Alert now for your free brochure, 1-800-410-0739.
Corporate media dominates the American opinion. Finding independent voices that counter this avalanche is becoming increasingly difficult. With the endless corruption running rampant throughout our government, independent voices are needed more than ever to battle the offensive against our freedoms and liberties. As a listener of RBN, no one understands this concept better than you. Now it's up to you to do your part. The time has come for you to take action and begin broadcasting the truth to hundreds or thousands of people every month. Sound impossible? Quite the contrary. With pointed slogans from LibertyStickers.com, you can reach countless sleeping Americans unaware that they live in a real-life wonderland. LibertyStickers.com has a huge inventory of political bumper stickers and messages that reflect the truth about our government, our politicians, and the future of America. With so many in stock, there's one perfect for you. Visit us today at LibertyStickers.com. Again, that's LibertyStickers.com. Do your part. Your voice is important. Let it be heard.
Bye. I'm Dr. Kayla Daniel, and I'm your host tonight for the Food Rights Hour, sponsored by the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund. To learn more about our work, please go to our website, farmtoconsumer.org. And please join us, because we are defending the rights of farmers all over this country to grow food and sell it to people directly. Good, real food. Food that's not processed and packaged in junk, but the food that is good for our climate and good for our health. My guest tonight is Lier Keith, author of the book, The Vegetarian Myth. And we've been talking about some of those myths. And what I would like to talk about at this point is vegetarianism and the environment. And I'm thinking right now about the Environmental Working Group. And a couple weeks ago, they suddenly had publicized all over the Internet, all over the newspapers, etc., that we should all take a pledge to have a meatless Monday. And somehow eating less meat is supposed to protect and save the planet. And wish it was that easy, but it's just not. So I'm not taking the pledge, and Lier, I bet you're not taking that pledge either.
No, I'm taking the anti-pledge. I'm going to eat as much grass-fed beef as I can every Monday.
Yeah, I think we should have a high-fat Friday.
That's right. That's right.
But more seriously, I think the pledge that I want to take is, how about, say, having one day a week where we have nothing that comes in a package, nothing that's not local, nothing that we haven't gotten from a farmer. I think something like that would be a really good start.
Totally agree. I think that would be wonderful.
Now, the Environmental Working Group, besides that being something that can make people feel good, where they're not doing very much, but they can actually feel good about themselves, it just seems that a lot of it's an exaggeration when they say, for example, that if we stop eating meat just once a week, we can cut as many carbon emissions as if we took 7.6 million cars off the road. And, of course, that sounds so good, but they're talking about factory farming, aren't they?
Yeah, all of these reports, there's always a new one, and they always take, the worst possible feedlot situation, and then they extrapolate that as if that's the only way to produce meat. So all the grain that's produced that gets, shoved down the throats of these poor cows, yeah, that's very destructive. But that is not the only way to grow, to raise beef or chicken or whoever you're raising. This is, factory farming only started in the 1950s, and the whole reason it began was because of the so-called Green Revolution. And in very blunt terms, this was just scientists figuring out how to extract nitrogen from oil and gas and then applying that as fertilizer. Well, it is super-duper fertilizer. It is completely dependent on fossil fuel, quite clearly. And then they bred some plants as well so that they would be shorter and their seed heads would be a little bit bigger. And so put those two things together and you have this absolute mountain of corn that was produced out of the Midwest. That corn had nowhere to go. There was just nobody to buy it. There was so much of it. At that point, it becomes so cheap that it made economic sense to start feeding it to cows. Now, corn is not their native diet. It, in fact, kills them. If you feed corn to cows for more than 60 days, they just drop dead. It burns holes in their stomachs, and it toxifies their livers. So if you're eating factory farmed beef, you're eating a very sick animal. And it also changes the actual meat and the dairy products in ways that are really bad for, the human body, for human nutrition. So just for instance, the omega-6 to omega-3 ratio will be completely off. There's not enough tryptophan. Corn itself is very low in the amino acid tryptophan, and that means that the meat that's produced is also very low in tryptophan. And tryptophan, of course, is the building block of serotonin. And we wonder why there's this epidemic of depression. Well, even if you eat a whole bunch of meat, you're not getting the building blocks that you need if that beef came from, corn-fed cows. So just across the board, this is a terrible idea. And the only reason they do it is because we live in a country that's controlled by agribusiness, and this was cheap. And that's all that matters is how they're going to make a profit. It's got nothing to do with health. It's got nothing to do with the environment. It has nothing to do with compassion for the animals. It's just about how do we get the cheapest product to the American consumer. And that's why we have factory farming, okay? Corn is not a good food to feed to cows. What they're made for is grass. So they take all of that. They assume this is a given, which it's not. And they assume that, you know, factory feedlots are a given. And then, yeah, they extrapolate out from there. Even given that, though, I mean, the figure that they use in that report is that animal agriculture accounts for 4.5% of the U.S. carbon footprint. 4.5%. It's minuscule. Even if that's true, which I don't believe, but even if that was true, I can't believe anybody would spend time and effort on such a minuscule amount of, you know, our total carbon release. It just seems, this is so clearly ideological, and it's got nothing to do with what's actually effective. There's a lot more that's wrong with that report that we could go into, but just even on that level, it seems absurd.
Well, one of the things that really strikes me is that these groups keep coming up with these, what I would call pop environmental solutions. You know, they're not really solutions. They sound good. They're easy to do. They make people feel good, maybe send in a donation. That has been one of the big frustrations to me, that these pop ideas, and I would call that the case here with the Environmental Working Group. You know, it sounds good, but nothing's really much being accomplished, is it?
No, and that's the problem with these so-called solutions that rely on consumer choices. These are social problems. These are vast political problems. It's about how our society has been arranged in a hierarchy of power. And yet, the only solutions we're being offered are personal solutions. And there really are no personal solutions to political problems. The only way we're going to solve these big social problems is through social movements that can actually apply pressure, you know, to the institutions that are corrupt or that are unjust, to either change them or dismantle them or take them over and completely redo them. And so we need social movements. We don't need another set of consumer choices, because that's not really, you know, the thing that ever changes those kinds of power hierarchies in the world. And I see a lot of the environmental movement sort of falling for these sort of silly consumer choices instead of actually trying to build the movement that we need.
Yeah, and it also strikes me that when we recommend something like, say, that Meatless Monday idea, so people don't eat meat on Monday, so what do they get instead? Probably some sort of soy protein thing that's overly packaged, that's come from clear across the country and is not saving the environment at all. And it just seems like the so-called solutions that they keep proposing don't solve anything. They're still talking about things that are completely not local, massive transportation costs, cost to the environment from all that transportation. Very frustrating. But I think we're putting some pressure on some of these big companies in the factory farming with our raw milk movement, though, because they're not liking us at all.
No, and you can see, you know, how beautifully the local and the traditional nutrition movement has really taken off. You know, it starts usually with just a small group of people who have a really good idea, and, you know, all hats off to Sally Fallon. You know, she figured this out, and she wrote an incredible book, and she laid that basic groundwork of just spreading the information. And from there, there's an upsurge. There's this, you know, upswelling of people who understand this and suddenly realize, I can't get this food anywhere. I can't find grass-fed beef. I can't find raw dairy. I can't find pastured eggs. It doesn't exist. And then the next step is you start to organize. And, you know, right away, we have the chapter leaders of Weston Price Foundation. And, you know, I've watched in the 10 years that I've been involved, you know, there were maybe 20 or 30 chapter leaders the first time I read Nourishing Traditions, and now they're in every state, they're around the world. It's amazing how this has exploded. So it's a very, very tight network of people who are, you know, from every level, they are fighting the powers that are keeping us from our natural food. And so on the local level, they've, you know, bought the raw milk, you know, the public health departments that are stopping raw milk, and, you know, sort of state level trying to change the law so that raw milk is legal, and then on up into the federal level where, you know, Weston Price people are testifying before Congress and they're putting pressure on the USDA. And, you know, on every level, these are the kinds of things that need to happen, where people actually put pressure on, you know, the nexus of power. You know, who can make this decision? How do we influence them? And how do we change this so that, you know, we actually have the freedom to pick the food that makes us healthy? So you can watch this whole movement develop, and it's been amazing to feel like I'm part of it, because it's just, you know, we're just seeing so much growth in this movement. People are getting really politicized about food, And they seem very savvy about, you know, how to do this. I mean, the whole cow share program is a really clever way around some of these laws. And then, you know, like the program that you're on now, the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund, I mean, that absolutely has to happen. There needs to be fundraising. People need, you know, this is the plan. This is how we're going to attack these laws. This is what we're going to do before Congress. This is what you can do in your local area. And so on every level, this is what needs to happen, is forming that political movement of people who know how to get active and how to change things for the better. So it's a great movement to be part of.
I think so, too. And all of you who are listening tonight, if you are not a member of the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund, please get right onto your computer and go on to farmtoconsumer.org, because we really need you to be a member, because we are fighting for the rights of farmers to sell products directly to consumers all over the country. There have been police actions against Amish farmers and small farmers all over, and we need everybody who can possibly join to do so, because we've got our hands full. This is a very, very important movement, and we need the support, the grassroots support.
I was just reading an article this morning that the FBI has gotten involved in targeting raw milk, and they even have a thing called Raw Milk Spy Camp, where they train agents how to, you know, work their way into raw milk networks. And they're mostly training women, of course, because the women can say, oh, I have a baby and I need raw milk for the baby because I'm not able to breastfeed, and they get the sympathy of the raw milk farmer and, you know, worm their way into the network and then get everybody's name, and you know, then they've compiled all this information, and they're able to do these raids on, you know, your local dairy farmer who's just doing their job. They're doing their best to provide good food for people.
Well, our country was founded by Thomas Jefferson and other gentlemen farmers, and they would have been astonished at what's going on now. I mean, one of our rights from the very beginning was to grow food and eat that food, and it was just considered a basic right. And to think that we're now fighting for that, it's very scary.
Yeah, it's kind of insane on one level. Like, who would even imagine that you couldn't just grow food and give it to your neighbors? Like, it just seems insane that anybody is trying to interfere in this process.
Well, it's all over, and it's not just things like raw milk. It's, you know, some little girl decides she wants to have a lemonade stand in order to raise some money for something.
Yeah.
And, you know, her lemonade might be completely processed, you know, packaged thing that she's just adding water to, but they're closing down the lemonade stands. I mean, what is this country coming to?
Well, we're only allowed to eat, like, super, super sterile food, which means that the only people who can produce it, of course, are giant corporations, and that's it. They want to shut everything down because all the profit has to go to them.
But as we know, the goal of the super sterile food, somehow that always runs amok.
Yeah,
because,
it does.
You know, they're fighting the local farmers as if everything's going to be contaminated, but the really serious contamination issues are coming right out of all the big farm factories, you know, the corporate farms, the manufacturing plants. And I actually dug up a ton of cases of contaminated soy products, which have come about, and people get the idea that meat's not safe, so they should eat soy. Well, hello, let's take a look at all the recall patterns we've got.
Right.
So it's pretty interesting, but what I have seen is when they stop a soy factory from something that's contaminated, they work with them to try to get back on track, whereas they're, you know, coming in with guns blazing with the farmers. So it's not exactly a match.
Yeah, no, it's not at all. And you can see who has the power, and that's agribusiness. So, of course, you know, the government's going to bend over backwards to do whatever they want, and then you've got the renegade people who are bucking the system. Well, the system comes down on you, and that's not a reason not to fight. We've got to fight, but this is what we're up against.
And we're up against a lot. Well, one of the things that I've always thought about, having researched the soy issue, is part of what I was studying was just the whole marketing of these different products as health foods, because it seems that people don't naturally want to eat things like soy products. People remember them back from the hippie days when they'd boil those things for hours and hours, and they never did get them to taste good, and they created a lot of gas, and they were basically, soy was considered a poverty food or a hippie food, or something you'd get in Russia or Cuba or someplace where you couldn't get meat. So they had a big image problem. So they actually had a very bright idea, which was to turn it into the image of a health food. And now we're seeing it not just with soy, where the average person believes soy is really, really healthy, but we're seeing it with these other plant foods, you know, everything from hemp to all these new ghastly products that are supposedly healthy.
Yeah, especially the ones that are so ultra-processed. When I start to explain to people how soy milk is actually made, they get scared, and they should. And it's like, that's what you're drinking. You know, it's created in a laboratory, essentially, and then, you know, it's an industrial product. It's got nothing to do with food anymore, and that's the only way to make it even vaguely palatable. I remember drinking that stuff for years. It was really nasty. So, you know, it's if you just sort of let your taste buds lead the way, maybe that's, the road out of all that marketing hype, but it seems like a lot of people have fallen for it.
So many people have fallen for the idea that what they naturally gravitate couldn't possibly be good for them. And, you know, people naturally don't like soy, but they keep hearing it's good for them, and they force themselves. And you know, right across the board, you hear that whole milk is bad for you, so they start drinking skim milk, and at first it tastes like something is terribly missing, which of course it is. But after a few years of that, it starts to taste normal to them, and so it goes.
You've probably had this experience, you know, where you invite somebody over for dinner or for lunch or something, and you feed them some real food, and they take one bite and then just look at you in complete astonishment, and they'll say something like, "I've never eaten anything like this." And I say back, "Yes, you never have. That's full fat dairy from a real cow and eggs from real chickens. It tastes good."
It definitely tastes wonderful. We'll get back and talk after the break. This is Kayla Daniel, and my guest is Lier Keith.
Estrogen dominance, a brand new 20th century disease, a phrase coined by Dr. John R. Lee 35 years ago. Dr. Lee proved that all the estrogen that is coming from food and water is having a devastating effect on our health. The rapid rise in breast cancer, uterine cancer, prostate cancer, weight gain, osteoporosis, feminizing of our boys and early puberty of our girls, and also the destruction of natural killer cell function. Natural killer cells are our only protection from cancer and viral infection. Dr. Lee found that using natural progesterone, about 20 milligrams per day, would not only reverse osteoporosis, but would greatly reduce the cancer issues, as well as dozens of other health challenges we face today. Visit our website, healthlinkamerica.com, to order the DVD on hormone imbalance. Learn how hormone imbalance destroys the immune system, and get started on natural progesterone and Cyto-S. It will not only change your life, it may in fact save your life. Once again, that website is healthlinkamerica.com.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
Are you or someone you know suffering from high blood pressure, cholesterol, or chest pains? Are you looking for a more natural way to overcome these health challenges? Extendovite is made from herbs known to help with these symptoms. Made from garlic, cayenne, hawthorn, and four other herbs, Extendovite goes to work detoxifying heavy metals and killing fungus and virus to enhance your overall health. For only $69.95 plus shipping and handling for a 2-month supply of either capsules or liquid, you too can begin on your path to better health. For more information, call 1-877-928-8822. That's 1-877-928-8822 or visit our website at heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
Berkey purification systems have long been recognized as the world's ultimate in water purification. Berkeys are used worldwide under normal, hostile, and emergency environments. Securing your access to good-tasting, sparkling, wholesome drinking water can be harder than you might expect. Water is often laced with chlorine, lead, high levels of harmful bacteria, and other unwanted chemicals and contaminants. Even bottled water can contain these contaminants, and moreover, it's expensive. Other purification systems are inferior. Most do remove pathogenic bacteria, and many remove the beneficial minerals that your body needs. Perhaps that's why Berkey systems have long been recognized as the world's ultimate in water purification. This simple, highly effective method of microporous, self-sterilizing, and recleanable black Berkey purification elements bring you the finest water purification system available anywhere. Call today, 1-800-724-2719. That's 1-800-724-2719. Or go to our online store, republicbroadcasting.org. Free shipping for a limited time only.
Welcome to the Food Rights Hour of the Republic Broadcasting Network. This show is sponsored by the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund. And I'm Dr. Kayla Daniel, and my guest tonight is Lierre Keith. And we have a caller, Danny from Pennsylvania. Danny, hello.
Hello.
How are you tonight, Danny?
Good. How are you all doing?
Good.
Hey, I had a question about corn.
Let's hear it.
You were talking about it earlier. Well, we supplement, even though a lot of people have chickens, for instance, and they free-range them. I know they, like in the wintertime, they'll supplement their food with corn. And so I'm wondering, now, are any of these animals able to digest this and get any nutrition out of the corn? And,
yeah.
And as far as people goes, I know some of the Native Americans used to, anyway, they used to ferment corn. So, is there any use at all for corn?
Okay, those are good questions. Thank you. A chicken has a very different digestive system than a cow. A cow is a ruminant, and cows should never eat corn. It's
okay.
just out of the question. But chickens can eat a whole bunch of things. They're very omnivorous, and they actually have very specific nutritional needs. I mean, they've been bred. They're domesticated animals, and they've been bred to produce a whole bunch of eggs every year. In the wild, the progenitors of a chicken would never have made that many eggs. So in order to keep those birds healthy and not have them on biological drawdown of their own body's resources, you need to provide a whole bunch of nutrition for them. And that's, you know, sort of the bargain we made with chickens when, you know, we joined forces and sort of domesticated each other. And so, yes, they can digest grain. Other people have made self-forage systems for chickens. So a lot of the permaculture people, for instance, will plant all kinds of small shrubs that will produce berries and nuts and, you know, all kinds of stuff, little pods that the chickens can eat. And then the chickens are pretty much self-sufficient for a lot of the year. But then you have to store something for them for over the winter. So, you know, you have to harvest whatever it is if you're going to be totally self-sufficient. Some farmers have switched from chickens, and they are more interested in ducks and geese because geese can actually live on nothing but grass. So you don't actually have to worry about that whole, you know, what else am I going to feed my chickens kind of problem. And ducks as well don't have to eat anywhere near as much. They can forage for their own food a lot more easily, and they can eat a lot more protein as well, so they can eat a lot more bugs. If you give too much protein to a chicken, she will get egg binding, and that's a kind of a nasty way to die. I had a chicken that almost died that way, and it's very unpleasant. And that was because she was eating the wrong food. You know, she got into some other food that wasn't hers, and she loved it, but it wasn't good for her. So I hope that's answering some of this. When you ferment grain, like you're speaking of the Native American practice, that's actually true around the globe, that cultures that have taken up agriculture discovered that if they fermented the grain, it was a lot more digestible. It made the nutrients in the grain more accessible to humans. And the reason is there's a lot of toxic substances that plants produce. They don't want to be eaten either. And they can't run the way that animals can, but what they produce instead are these toxins. And one of the substances that the seeds have, they're called phytates, phytic acid. And in your digestive tract, the phytic acid from a seed, which includes all grains, will bind with minerals. And that means that you don't get the minerals. The minerals are flushed out of your body. And this is one way that plants fight back. If you eat me, you're going to get hurt. And that's one of the ways that, you know, plants will hurt us. So by doing these various fermentation techniques of soaking and, you know, letting them really ferment, you actually disable those substances, those toxic substances. So people were smart to do that.
Okay, well, thank you.
Well, thank you. We will be back after the hour. This is the Food Rights Hour with the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund. Good evening and welcome to the Republic Broadcasting Network. You are tuned in to the Food Rights Hour of the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund. I'm Dr. Kayla Daniel, and my guest tonight is Lier Keith, author of The Vegetarian Myth and co-author of a new book called Deep Green Resistance. But before we talk about that, I want to urge you all to learn more about other Republic Broadcasting Network shows. The website is republicbroadcasting.org. And I also urge you to go to farmtoconsumer.com and learn more about the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund and why we do want you to become one of our members. Lier, your Vegetarian Myth book has made such a difference to so many people. And now you've gone on and you've done another book, and this time you joined up with Eric McBay and Derek Jensen, and the book's title is Deep Green Resistance. What led you to write this book?
Well, to put it very frankly, the planet is dying. Every biological indicator is going in the wrong direction. Every day, 200 species go extinct. So that was today, that was yesterday, it'll be tomorrow. We're just losing huge chunks of life every hour that passes. And the carbon keeps rising, and the oceans are dying, and 99% of the old-growth forests are gone. There's not a lot left to take at this point, and this culture just feels sociopathological. It's beyond me that anybody could destroy their planet, but that's what's happening before our eyes. So we wrote this book to try to address the problem, because, I mean, not only are most people in denial about the seriousness of this, but the solutions that were being offered do not in any way match the scale of the problem. So we wanted to lay out the problem, historically where it starts, you know, what it looks like now, and then ways that people can get active to actually build the kind of serious political movement that we need to stop this destruction before it's too late. And we've only got about 10 years left before we reach the biological tipping points, past which there will be no return. You know, if the Amazon rainforest is destroyed to a certain point, it will never recover. That a lot of these tipping points, you know, once it starts, it becomes exponential. So it grows and grows. And so, for instance, when the ice starts melting, you know, above the Arctic Circle, what happens is there's a dark spot because the ice is melted, and now you can see either, you know, ground or water, but now the sunshine, the heat from the sun absorbs, okay, into the dark instead of being reflected by the snow. And what that means is that more snow, more ice melts even faster, and then the dark spot gets even bigger, which means even more heat gets absorbed, and then even more ice melts even faster. So it just starts snowballing, and no pun intended, but it just gets worse and worse. So we see this all around with biological systems, that once they're set on the sort of downward spiral, it just accelerates and accelerates. And it's very frightening. These are very scary times to be alive, and I worry for the future of all of us and all of our children's children at this point.
And we are really seeing the Earth angry right now with the kinds of hurricanes we're getting. Right now, the Hurricane Irene is so much in the news. I think the Earth is angry.
Yeah, and Texas is experiencing the worst drought they've ever seen. The wildlife is just dropping dead. All the farmers, everybody's had to sell off their animals. There's just, whether it's goats or cows or horses, it's just basically a mass slaughter because there's no water and the animals are all dying. And it's drought. It's an extensive drought. Last year, Siberia was on fire all across Russia. There were just these horrible fires because it had never been that hot in Russia in anybody's memory.
And New Mexico, where I live, it's been burning up.
Yeah.
We do have a caller, Jason from New York. Jason, are you here?
Can you hear me?
Yes. Hi, Jason.
Hey, hello. Leo, this is, I know you shifted to focus on your new book, but I just finished The Vegetarian Myth last week, and it seemed like many of the criticisms were applicable to omnivorous sectors of food production as well. And when I read it, it seemed like the wording of the book was more focused to vegetarians than it might have been.
Jason, we need to go to commercial break, but I'll bring you in right after, okay?
Yeah, certainly.
Okay, thank you. You're listening to the Food Rights Hour, and we'll be back. Welcome to the Food Rights Hour. I'm Dr. Kaylee Daniel, and I'm your host, and my guest tonight is Lierre Keith. The Food Rights Hour is sponsored by the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund, and we're on the Republic Broadcasting Network. I have a caller, Jason. Jason, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Great.
So before we got cut off, I was just curious that a lot of your analysis and critique in vegetarianness seems to apply to the omnivorous sections of food production as well. And I was curious about your choice to focus on the vegetarian argument, and if I was wondering if it was a response to your personal identity in politics, or if because you felt people's environmental sensibilities were being misguided or mischanneled, and maybe how you feel that local restructuring food economy plays into the deep green resistance. Thank you.
Great. That is a wonderful question. You sort of answered it already, because it's absolutely the second of the options that you gave me. I felt like the problems with what omnivorous people are eating, that those problems have been fairly well covered by other books and other activists, other writers. And the people that I really wanted to reach are the vegans and the vegetarians, and it's very specifically because I think those are the people who care the most. They are the people who are the most impassioned about what is happening to this planet. And I feel like we've been led completely astray, that, you know, actually the best way to embody those underlying ethics is not through a vegan diet. It's actually through, you know, eating foods that are about the repair of our planet and not the foods that are the destruction of the planet. And if you're eating agricultural foods, it's just nothing but destruction. And we don't know that in this culture, because we've been doing agriculture for so long that nobody even knows to question it. So I wanted to bring all that to the fore and kind of just explain it in the best way that I could, so that we had more information and could make better decisions about what it was going to take to actually repair this planet. As far as the deep green resistance question goes, I think food is tremendously important to the movement that we're trying to create. And that's because we've really got a two-part goal. And the second goal is to defend and rebuild just, sustainable, and autonomous human communities. Part of that has to be assisting in the recovery of the land. And the most important thing that we can do is really repair the prairies and the grasslands around the world. And one of the reasons I say that is because if we could repair even 75% of the world's trashed out rangelands around the globe, we could sequester all of the carbon that's been released since the beginning of the industrial age in under 15 years. So in under 15 years, the carbon in the atmosphere would be under 333 parts per million. Now, Bill McKibben and all the scientists that back him up say 350 is the absolute top. We could drop it below that. It would be 333 parts per million in under 15 years. That's how good grass is at building topsoil. So if we could just do that repair, it would go such a long way toward just stopping the horror of catastrophic climate change, which is what we're looking at otherwise. And I want people to understand that. And we cannot eat grass. Okay, we are not ruminants. The food that humans can eat that comes out of grasslands is, of course, the megafauna. So it's the bison or the cattle or the wildebeest or, you know, whatever it is that grows on, you know, where you live. That's what we can eat, and we can't eat the grass. So, and in order to have those grasslands function again as self-sustaining communities, they've got to have their ruminants. So all of this works as a piece. You know, the grass needs to be eaten in order to grow. The animals have to be eaten by predators, or, you know, they will over-reproduce themselves and degrade the land. And then ultimately we all die, and the soil eats us all in the end. So that's the cycle of life. And we need to repair that cycle and then participate in it again. And so that's a large part of sort of the underlying vision of deep green resistance, is to repair the planet. So I like to say we have to repair, restore, rejoin. We have to repair the forests and the prairies and the wetlands. We have to restore the animals that belong there, especially the megafauna, and then we've got to rejoin as humble participants once more and, you know, promise that we will never again be destroyers of those communities. So that was a great question. Thanks for asking.
Thank you, Jason. And we have another caller, Pam from Boulder. Pam, are you there?
Hello?
Hi, Pam.
Yes, hi, thanks. I want to say thanks so much for this interview, and I'm looking right now at page 483 of Deep Green Resistance Strategy to Save the Planet, and it's the chapter entitled Our Best Hope, which is a great title, and great title also for the great book. And I'm looking at section 4 here, which is Deep Green Resistance Requires Repair of the Planet, which Leah was just speaking so eloquently about here to Jason. And I'm reading here, stopping the destruction requires an honest look at the culture that a true solar economy can support. We need a new story, but we don't need fairy tales. And I... First one, I thank you so much, Lierre, for what I see as your commitment to reality, which is hard to find and very precious. And I want to ask, you know, as far as this message here about the new story, and it goes on here, actively repairing the planet requires understanding the damage, and says people are still missing the correct information, which you've mentioned this evening as well. And I just want to ask, you've mentioned Jill Souten's books and Western Price and a few things in this interview, but could you maybe mention a few other people? I know Derek Jensen's books and Eric's books and some others, you know, already, but could you mention some particularly useful sources for getting, you know, these understandings we need? You mentioned we need to understand how alive soil is, and we don't understand that, and sustainable population levels, some of these things that the understanding is so lacking in the population. Can you suggest some places to go for increasing our understanding?
Oh, there's so many good ones. Definitely Derek Jensen. If you want to read Endgame by Derek or A Language Older Than Words, those are my two favorite. And he also co-authored What We Leave Behind with Eric McVeigh, which is also a really wonderful book. And he just walks people through how destructive civilization has been, especially industrial civilization, all the kinds of emotional blocks we have to facing that destruction, where that destruction comes from, what it means to us personally in our lives, how it's connected to the sort of broad-scale abuse that happens to women, to children, to people of color around the world, how these hierarchies are so embedded in our culture, you know, in our religions, in our psychology, and, you know, that we're going to have to dismantle all of this from the most personal around to the most global, but how it's all connected. And I just think he's a wonderful writer, and I'm just so pleased that I got to write a book with him. But anyway, Derek Jensen's a great place to start. And then, you know, if your interest is really about repair, ecological repair, there's lots of good stuff out there, but one book that I have just fallen in love with is called Rewilding the West. And it's by Richard Manning. And all of Richard Manning's books are phenomenal. This man is absolutely in love with prairies. And Rewilding the West is a story about what has happened to the West, all of the, you know, basically west of the Mississippi, in the last 100-150 years, basically since the, you know, white colonial settlement, and how the place has just been trashed because they tried to do agriculture. It was didn't work, and they just destroyed the topsoil, and then they moved on to cattle, which don't actually belong there. It's the wrong animal for that ecosystem. It really needs to be bison. And what it would take to repair that land, and what happens when you bring the bison back. And it's just a phenomenal book. And I would also recommend Against the Grain, which is his critique of agriculture. I learned a lot reading that book as well. But Rewilding the West, I think, is a great place to start. If especially if you live in Colorado, I think you'd really, really enjoy this book because it's about the place you live especially. So I don't know if that gives you a good place to start, but those are some of my favorites right now.
Wow, that's great. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Pam.
And in terms of books about the proper kind of farming, we have some very exciting news. Joel Salatin has a new book coming out, and this time with a major publisher, and it's called good. Folks, This Ain't Normal, A Farmer's Advice for Happier Hens, Healthier People, and a Better World. I can't wait to read
phenomenal.
It. It sounds so good.
I'm so excited. Every time he comes out with a new one, it's just a wonderful week or two while you get to read it.
Yeah, and they're calling him the high priest of the prairie.
That's right, that's right.
But this really is very exciting when something so mainstream as the New York Times calls Joel Salatin the high priest of the prairie. We know we're making some inroads, so this really is exciting.
Now, I remember the first time I saw Joel Salatin quoted in the New York Times, I just stood up and started cheering. It was like, I can't believe it, we've hit the mainstream. This is so phenomenal, and it couldn't be a better person. I mean, Joel Salatin is the one. You know, he's really spearheaded so much of this.
He's the one. Well, you're doing your job, and he's doing his, and it all matters. We're all making it build. We have yet another caller, Craig from Ontario. Craig, welcome to the Food Rights Hour.
Hi there, Rob. Just have two questions for your guest, Lee Smith.
Go ahead.
Vegetarian. Yeah, thanks. Vegetarians, you always think a very good argument. They say, you know, if you have an acre of land, that can feed one cow. But an acre of land can feed, say, 100 people. Like, to me, that's a very convincing argument. How do you counteract that argument in terms of supplying food to people?
Right. Well, it's not actually true. You might be able to feed that many people once, but from that point forward, the land will degrade because you've cleared the perennial cover off that land. The moment that you did that, the soil was being drawn down. So every year you will have less soil and less fertility. So every year you'll be able to feed fewer and fewer people. And in the end, what you'll have is a desert. So you have to apply things from the outside. It's not a closed loop. And at this point, what we're applying, of course, is fossil fuel. So we're, you know, it's all the nitrogen comes from oil that is or natural gas, and they use a tremendous amount of oil to actually extract the nitrogen from it. And that's where it's all coming from. That's where the fertilizer is coming from. And so that's sort of the end result of agriculture, is you end up with a desert. And you can look around the world. Iraq was cedar forest so thick that sunlight never touched the ground. We've all seen pictures of Iraq now because of the horrible war. Nobody in their right mind would call that place the Fertile Crescent now.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Craig. That was a great question. We're going to take a break now, and actually we've got several callers to talk with after the break, so please stay tuned. This is the Republic Broadcasting Network, and this is the Food Rights Hour. Food Rights Hour, and I'm Dr. Kayla Daniel, your host, and my guest tonight is Lier Keith, author of The Vegetarian Myth and co-author of Deep Green Resistance. And we've got a whole bunch of callers lined up. Werner from New Brunswick, are you there?
Good evening, ladies. Good evening, Mrs. Keith and Dr. Daniel. You have quite an interesting show.
We do.
And when Mrs. Keith, when she was talking about agriculture, I grew up on a farm, and we had mixed farming. And we were doing crop rotations. And I would underseed plow down crops in order to increase the organic matter in the soil. And this is first and foremost unnecessary plowing. It breaks down the humus in the soil, and it impoverishes the soil. So what is being taken out, it has to be put in. But here we have to look at agriculture the way it has developed now as a whole, and the centralization of the population in big cities. This is not a sustainable way to deal with the resources of this planet and with the soil, because we are part of the biological system. And the same way as with animals and so, our waste has to go back where the food came from. And not that our food is being produced halfway around the world or thousands of miles away, and the waste, most of the waste, goes into the ocean.
Yes, I agree. There's a concept of your food shed, and so a lot of the people who endorse a local diet, and they're called locavores, I think it's a very cute name, it suggests it's probably about 50 miles that, you know, without fossil fuel, that's about as far as we would get in a few days. And so if your food comes from within your food shed, That's about, you know, what the local area should be. And, you know, around the globe, it just isn't possible anymore because a whole bunch of land has been destroyed. And on top of that, the human population has just simply gotten too big. And this is one of the other problems with agriculture, is that as people are drawing down all the biological reserves of the planet, especially in the soil, it, you know, temporarily lets the human population get really big. And then, of course, the whole thing collapses. And this is the pattern of this living arrangement called civilization, where you have a power center, you know, in the middle of the whole thing, and then there's this population explosion, and they draw down all the resources, they take everything they can, usually with the military, and then eventually the whole thing caves in. And you can watch this all over, from China to India to South America, ancient Rome. It's the same pattern over and over because the whole thing is on drawdown. So it's an extractive activity, and there's no way for this to be sustained. And eventually the topsoil collapses. So David Montgomery, in his wonderful book, Dirt, says it's, you know, that civilizations last as long as there's soil, and that's usually somewhere between 800 and 2,000 years, and then they're over. And then what you have is the collapse. Until very recently, those collapses, while they may have been unpleasant, at least they were human scale, which is to say that as that was all happening, it would take two or three generations for the whole system to kind of give in, and then people would sort of slowly be reabsorbed into the wilderness around them. So whether that was forests or whether it was prairies or, you know, wherever it was they lived, they could get reabsorbed back into the still existing indigenous communities around the civilized center. That is over because everything has been taken now by civilization, by industrial civilization in particular. When this crash comes, there's not going to be anywhere to go. And that's why we're really up against the wall here in terms of facing, you know, the reality of the situation. There is hope. There would be ways out, but we really need all the major institutions now that rule the planet are going to have to get on board if we've got any chance of actually, you know, taking effective action, to kind of stop this just horrendous crash that we're looking at.
We are dealing with another problem. And when I look at the East Coast here in Eastern Canada and the New England states, we cannot really say that there is overpopulation. Like in Maine, New Hampshire, New Brunswick, Nova Scotia, Prince Edward Island. Like, for example, in New Brunswick, we got only about a little bit over 10 people per square kilometer, you know. But there has been some other shenanigans have been going on here for a long while. And I think it's similar here has been in Maine, that we have been dealing with environmental terrorists. Basically, a region that at one time was self-sufficient is now importing on the average roughly about 90% of the food. And what I've been documenting now for the last nearly 40 years, the illegal dumping of pesticides on farmland, the killing of farmers' livestock. So, basically, that has brought agriculture, caused the demise of most of agriculture. A perfectly working system has been destroyed for commercial greed. And the so-called experts, they were part of that. They were brainwashing the people, you know, and people were looking to them as gods. Those with their PhD and so with the experts. But the farmers that were farming the land, they were farming sustainable. And the expertise, it wasn't just only their expertise, it was expertise that had been accumulated over hundreds, maybe 1,000 years, and passed on. And a lot of this expertise, it was being basically kicked to the curb.
Well, thank you so much for your contribution, Werner. We have to go to a commercial break, and after that break, we're going to talk to Joni from Florida and Megan from Pennsylvania. I'm Dr. Kayla Daniel. My guest is Liera Keith. This is the Food Rights Hour. Welcome to the Food Rights Hour of the Republic Broadcasting Network. To learn more about shows on the Republic Broadcasting Network, the website is republicbroadcasting.org. This is the Food Rights Hour, sponsored by the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund. And I'm Dr. Kayla Daniel, and my guest tonight is Liera Keith, author of The Vegetarian Myth and co-author of Deep Green Resistance. Liera's website is www.lierre, LierKeith.com. So LierKeith.com. So we have a couple callers. Joni from Florida. Joni, welcome to the Food Rights Hour.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
I can.
Okay. Thank you. It's a wonderful show. This is my first time listening to it. I am so interested in, you know, real food, natural farming, and local, keeping everything local as much as possible. And but I was wondering if you could comment on the GMOs that, you know, we're faced with today and we have to deal with and eat, and how bad that is for the body. And I'm a retired massage therapist, and I've been studying nutrition and the body ever since I was 28 years old, which is over 40 years ago. So I was just, you know, and I know what the body needs, and I'm still finding places where I can get milk, but, you know, I don't expect that to go on for long. But, you know, and I see how much better I feel when I have that in my diet. Anyway, getting back, if you could comment on the GMOs that, you know, and how bad they are for us, and why don't, you know, so many people just don't get it.
I'd like to comment first that for really amazing information about the whole GMO issue, Jeffrey Smith is the expert. And if you Google his name, Jeffrey Smith, he's got a couple of books out, Seeds of Deception and a couple others. And he is the man to go to in terms of information and appropriate protesting of GMO. And the short answer that I'm going to give is I will not knowingly eat anything that's GMO. And I expect our guest tonight, Lierre, you probably got some ideas about GMO, too.
Yeah, well, they're totally in line with both of yours. I won't touch the stuff. And I think that it's very telling that around the world people have rejected these. You know, Europe, India, everywhere, people have done their best to fight them. And in the United States, they've just laid down and they take it. And I don't understand that. These are foods that have never existed before. We have no idea what they're going to do to us. We have no idea what they're going to do to the natural world. Barbara Kingsolver is a wonderful writer. You know, she started as a biologist. She's written many wonderful novels, but she has a book of essays as well, and she's got a whole article about genetically modified foods. And the title of the article is A Fist in the Face of God. And that's what she calls GMOs, and I could not agree more strongly. This is just a place we had no right to go, and we're violating the integrity of the organism, and that's just not a boundary that we should be violating. That's a boundary that needs to be respected. That's developed over millions, if not billions, of years. We've got no right, you know, breaking that boundary down. And I just find it really horrifying that the American public has accepted this. I mean, pretty much at this point, it's everywhere. You know, corn is basically in everything, and most of the corn is genetically modified. And so there's not really, unless you're going to eat, you know, the way that I do and go to a lot of lengths to get your own food from real farms, it's there, and we've got to fight this because they're winning.
And what a lot of people don't understand, a lot of very educated, committed people, is that even at places like Whole Foods Market, where you could reasonably expect there are not GMOs, the bottom line is there are. And that is so sad, and it really tells us that we really need to do whatever we have to do to buy directly from our local farmers, as well, of course, as grow our own food where we can as well. And stand up to Monsanto where we can.
That's right.
And could you repeat the name of that book, Something in the Face of God?
Pardon me?
The name of the book or the article?
The article is called
Something in the Face of God.
And it's by Barbara Kingsolver.
And the title?
The title of the book is something like High Tide in Tucson. That might not be exactly right, but it's something like that.
Okay, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Joni. And we have another guest, Megan from Pennsylvania. Megan, welcome to the Food Rights Hour.
Thank you, Kayla, and thank you, Lier, both. I really enjoyed the vegetarian myth. I got that last fall, and like you, I did vegetarianism pretty heavily for the better part of 20 years, and I'm still trying to rebuild my health from that. But I had read, I remember you mentioning, Lear, I think that you were looking into a subject for a book about grasslands yourself. And I didn't know if you'd ever heard of a gentleman from Zimbabwe who has used ruminant animals, mob grazing, to rebuild desert parts of Zimbabwe, actually, where there's standing water in parts of the desert year-round. His name's Alan Savory.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. He's wonderful.
He's a really amazing, you know, and like any good new thinker, of course, all the other scientists tell him you can't possibly rebuild the desert by running cattle and goats. And, you know, I know that he is doing workshops here in the United States now, and he lives part-time in New Mexico. But I just, and I do remember that he actually trained a large portion of employees from the USDA, maybe even as much as 20 years ago, on how to do this mob grazing on our rangeland and rebuild the rangeland instead of complaining about the cattle and the wild horses destroying it, how we could actually be using these techniques to rebuild all the prairie land and the grasslands out west. And I think I saw in an article recently the USDA may actually be doing trainings in the northeastern United States this year, which would be very exciting. But I also think he'd be a great presenter for the Weston Price Conference or for your show, Kayla, because he does know a lot about dirt and animals and how they work together to rebuild the earth. It's very fascinating stuff.
Fantastic. I'll keep that in mind. You know, we're always looking for great speakers.
Oh, and to the last caller, too, Jeffrey Smith on his Responsible Technology website, you can learn quite a lot from that, and he also does do activist training, which I took earlier this spring. So, you know, if somebody's looking for tools to educate about GMOs, he's got lots of helpful things on his website. So I just wanted to thank you both. It's been a great show tonight.
Well, thank you for calling in, Megan. You've given us some very good suggestions, and I hope people are listening to that, and I hope they're going to start taking appropriate actions here. So, Lier, you've got Deep Green Resistance out now, and you're working on a new book, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm trying to write a book about prairies and about, I feel like one of our last hopes for this planet to survive is to repair those prairies and sequester that carbon and let those species come back. So I'm trying to write a book about why this is important and how it might be done. Yeah, it's very exciting. I mean, I've never really lived on a prairie. I grew up in the Northeast United States, so I forests are really feel more like my home. But the more that you learn about prairies, you can't help but fall in love with them, and especially the animals that live there, like the bison are just amazing. The more you learn about them, it's just, you have to be in awe of what they do, and, you know, they're the keystone species, really, of the prairie, and they've been pretty well wiped out, so I like the idea of bringing them back. I think we're going to have to do that, and it's a hopeful thing to think about, because it could really work, so.
I like that, too, and if we're going to call Joel Salatin the High Priest of the Prairie, I guess we can call you the High Priestess.
If the book is good.
Do you know how long it'll be before that book comes out?
Oh, it's going to be a while. I've only just gotten started on it, so, I'm trying, but it's a lot. A lot of information to kind of absorb and then try to figure out how to present it, as books always are. But can I tell you about another website, though, real quick?
Yes, please.
If people are interested in Deep Green Resistance and our book and what we're trying to build, we actually have a website for the movement, and it's called, very simply, deepgreenresistance.org. And you can find everything you want to know about what we're up to on that website.
Well, fantastic, and I think that's a great idea, and I'm so glad Megan mentioned the fact that Jeffrey Smith trains people to be effective resistors, because, you know, a lot of us are trying to do that. We want to be effective, we want to be peaceful, but we want to be effective, and, you know, we do have to be persistent and somewhat aggressive in order to make things work, and Jeffrey's got some excellent tools. Now, we do have Craig from Ontario is back. He has one more question. So, Craig, welcome again to the Food Rights Hour.
Hi there. Sorry. Just had a question, and the reason I asked is I just got a bit nervous, Lear, when you, in terms of your speaking, you talked a bit about sustainability, carbon units. You're talking about a 350, that measurement. And I'm just trying to find out, do you subscribe to the whole global warming view as espoused by Al Gore and David Suzuki? Do you agree with them on global warming?
Yeah, I don't think there's really a question. That's only in the United States that people are questioning this. It's around the globe. It's already happening. People are underwater. You know, that all that.
Have you ever heard, have you ever heard of ClimateGate at all, where they've disproven the mathematics? And all
you know, that was one pair of scientists that did something kind of stupid, but, you know, overwhelmingly the scientific, you know, consensus was in 10 years ago. So you can go to lab and watch.
I'm sorry. That's all I need to know. Thank you very much. Good night.
Okay, and we have one more caller, a new caller, Tyler from Connecticut. Tyler, welcome to the Food Rights Hour.
Thanks. Can you hear me?
We can. Go ahead.
Cool. I was just calling to comment, actually. I read Lear's book about 2 years ago, and I was always an omnivore, but I read her book and found the stuff she had to say about grains and everything very interesting, and actually went off the grains for a few weeks and had a chronic disease at the time, and it really helped me a lot, and so I just wanted to say that thanks a lot, and she really improved my health by writing that book.
Well, thank you so much for calling, Tyler. That's a wonderful story. Do you want to share more about what was wrong with you, just to give people inspiration, or if it's too personal, that's fine, but sometimes it really helps to hear the details.
Sure. I actually had Lyme disease, and I might still have it, I don't know, technically, you know, but it bothers me a lot less now that I cut out eating grains, and they had been causing me a lot of inflammation and a lot of problems, like every time I ate them I noticed, and I guess I didn't put it together enough to quit eating them until I read your book, so.
You know, you're not the only Lyme person that I've heard from. That's a pretty common fan mail that I get is depression, you know, there's a bunch of them, but Lyme disease is definitely on the list of what I've heard back from people. So I'm really glad that worked for you, because it's a terrible condition.
Yeah, it definitely improved my quality of life a lot, reading your book, so thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Tyler.
Thank you. Well, I think a lot of us have been experiencing more and more health problems from grain-heavy diets, plant-based diets, soy diets. I joke about some people aren't really vegetarians, which would imply, you know, veggies, but soyitarians and pastaitarians and wheatitarians and bagelitarians, etc. And, you know, we're just seeing so many problems originating usually with gut problems. And, of course, that's the first area you start working on trying to heal. And we're just seeing so many people now with gut problems and allergies and immune system problems. And, of course, cancer and other diseases are epidemic. And we're all just being told to eat plant-based diets. And that really doesn't work for us, does it?
No, and I've been on the GAPS diet for the last 8 months because I have an autoimmune disease, and it's working, and it's really hard to eat such a restricted diet, but, you know, when you have an autoimmune disease, you don't really have a choice. It's your life, so you just kind of have to do it.
And you really are quite a bit stronger, aren't you?
Oh, it's helped a lot.
Well, that's really wonderful, and we work with a whole lot of people. I mean, I know you do because, of course, many, many people are emailing you and probably calling you up every single day because your book, The Vegetarian Myth, has been so influential. And, of course, many long-term vegans, of course, they relate to you, say, in a way they would never relate to me because I don't have that history. So
yes,
you're helping people.
part because I don't really have a medical degree, so I can't really give out, you know, medical advice, but I'm able to give them some general guidelines, certainly. And then if they need more help, there are certainly doctors and other practitioners who I can recommend very highly. And so it's very helpful because I'm able to at least direct them, especially if something serious. You know, they shouldn't be out there on their own, just kind of stabbing in the dark, trying to figure it out. It does help to have some guidance from people. But there are, you know, doctors and nurses that work primarily with recovering vegetarians, and that's really helpful that that's out there now.
It really is. I'm a clinical nutritionist, and I just got back from a conference in Baltimore. And, you know, we're all aware of all of these problems, and yet somehow the myth is still out there that you're going to be healthier if you have a plant-based diet. And for most people, that doesn't mean a lot of vegetables, which, of course, are absolutely fine, but it tends to mean a lot of grains, a lot of wheat and pasta and bagels and minimal meat and so forth, and then people are eating a lot of soy, and it just goes on and on because so many of these foods like wheat and soy are so allergenic for people, very destructive to the gut, creating a whole lot of problems. So that the health practitioners are seeing it, but we're just having such a time getting the word out.
I'm imagining that people are still, you know, in your profession are still sort of embracing the whole lot low-fat, high-carb paradigm, or are some of them getting over that?
Well, you know, that's a really interesting thing because one of my frustrations is when I go to these professional conferences, they're still talking low-fat, 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 and they're not usually recommending no meat, et cetera, no animal products, but they are low-fat. And then to compensate for the low-fat, they're going and recommending all sorts of supplements, you know, bag loads of supplements to compensate for the fact that the food is artificially made low-fat.
Right.
And it's all about processing and packaging. You know, when people take whole milk and turn it into skim milk, then people want ice cream and you sell food
right.
products. Okay, well, we need to go for yet another commercial break, but we'll be right back. This is the Food Rights Hour, Republic Broadcasting Network.
Introducing IXL Anti-Friction Metal Conditioner. IXL works at the molecular level to reduce friction by penetrating into and bonding onto the microscopic openings of the walls of ferrous-based metals. The surfaces become smoother and denser, and this reduces the heat, friction, and metal expansion and wear caused by moving metal surfaces. The benefits are reduced maintenance activities and cost, increased fuel efficiency, and prolonged equipment life. It will not clog pipes, injectors, or supply lines, does not build up or accumulate on itself as do many other additives. IXL does not contain moly, PTFE, or graphite. It also offers the tremendous benefit of being non-toxic. It is used for a friction reducer and performance enhancer in gas or diesel engines, transmissions, automatic or standard gearboxes, turbos, electric motors, outdrives, lathe, and cutting applications. Go to republicbroadcasting.org, then to our online store, or call us at 800-724-2719. That's 800-724-2719.
Are you serious about maintaining or improving your health? If you are, you need Terravim. Terravim offers a full line of vitamins, minerals, and herbs for people serious about enjoying a healthy lifestyle. Our product lines include Alamax, Magnesen, Silver 100, Natura Health Products, Gala Herbs, and Terravim's private label, and undergo rigorous clinical studies by leading researchers and contain physician-grade research-based therapeutic doses of nutrients. All of our vitamin, mineral, and herb products are manufactured under current good manufacturing practices in an FDA-registered production facility, and we guarantee that the ingredients in the supplements are exactly what's on the label. We also provide free consultation for all our products along with general wellness information. All orders over $45 ship free, and all orders received by 3 p.m. ship the same day. When shopping online, enter the coupon code RBN for a 10% discount. To order now, call 1-866-647-4372. That's 1-866-647-4372, or visit terravim.com.
If you're the mother of a child with behavior problems, I'd like to talk to you. My name is Janet Lehman. I'm a behavioral therapist and a mom. I know what it's like when the child you love becomes a defiant, out-of-control child who disrespects you. That's why my husband James and I created the Total Transformation, the program that tens of thousands of moms are now using to turn around their child's behavior. If you've heard about the Total Transformation and wondered if it will work for you, now you can try it for free. I'm willing to give away 1,000 programs today for free. All you need to do is get the program and let us know how it works for you. We'll let you keep it for free. I know the Total Transformation works because I used these techniques with my own son and with troubled kids for over 30 years. Let me prove to you that it works by giving you the program for free.
Call now. 1-800-583-1093. 1-800-583-1093. That's 1-800-583-1093.
Hello, it's the Food Rights Hour, and I'm your host, Kayla Daniel, and my guest is Lierre Keith. We do have time for one final caller, Bill, for Atlanta, from Atlanta. But before I bring Bill on, I want to let everyone know that Lierre Keith's website is lierrekeith.com. So if you'd like to see what she's up to and contact her, lierrekeith.com. Bill, are you there? Welcome to Food Rights Hour.
Kayla, I am.
Can you hear me? Yeah, we can hear
you. Hi,
Lierre.
Hi. I just want to say to Kayla and Lierre, thank you very much for tonight's show. It's been great. I'd also like to thank all the callers that called in.
Well, you're very welcome.
Well, thank you. Did you have a question, Bill?
No, not right offhand. There was a lot of information, a lot of very good information, and I've written most of it down. And mainly I just wanted to say thank you for tonight's show. It's been great.
Fantastic. Thank you. Lierre has been a wonderful guest. Let's bring in Leanna from Colorado. Welcome, Leanna.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to call in and say how much I appreciate Lierre and everything she has talked about. And I'd also just wanted a little bit more information. I mean, the weight of everything that's happening right now in the world is pretty, you know, extreme and really time for us to move. And I wanted to hear a little bit more about the Deep Green Resistance and the strategy on that and how maybe people could get involved in this movement that seems to be maybe a good solution to these problems on this planet.
Lierre, can you give us that website again? Because we've got 1 minute left and want to give people that resource again.
Great. It's deepgreenresistance.org. And you can go there and read everything that we are suggesting about how we're going to turn this around before it's too late. And it's a huge project, but it has to be done. And I know there are people listening to the show who have passion and the compassion to do what's necessary. Right now we have our first action. We've got people in Washington, D.C. trying to stop the Key Line, the tar sands pipeline that's supposed to be coming down from Canada. It's just a horrendous environmental nightmare, and it's really exciting to have Deep Green Resistance people, you know, on the ground in D.C. Taking part in this really historic protest. And we hope to be organizing a lot more serious civil disobedience around the country to try to stop the destruction of our one and only home.
Well, thank you. That's very exciting.
Well, thank you so much. We've had so many callers tonight. Lierre, you've been a wonderful guest, and I think I've been feeling a whole lot of love from all your callers and probably from a whole lot of listeners tonight. I wish you great success, continuing success with the Vegetarian Myth now in its sixth printing, and Deep Green Resistance hot off the press, and a book on the prairies coming up. My guest tonight is Lierre Keith, and her website is lierrekeith.com. This is the Food Rights Hour on the Republic Broadcasting Network. And to learn more about freedom shows on the Republic Broadcasting Network, the website is republicbroadcasting.org. And please do join the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund, because we do have to support our local farmers, and in many cases we need to defend our local farmers. So please join us, farmtoconsumer.com. Thank you for joining us tonight. I'm Dr. Kayla Daniel, and you were tuned in to the Food Rights Hour. Thank you. Good night.
Thank you.